Side 4, Rising Sun by Michael Crichton. Continuing on page 130. By now they were near the center of the room, and the camera was shooting almost directly down. All we saw was the top of his head. I said, "Does he look Japanese to you?"
"Fuck, who can tell? How many other cameras were in that room?"
"Four others."
"Well, his face can't be blocked in all four. We'll nail his ass."
I said, "You know, Tom, this guy looks pretty big. He looks taller than she is, and she was a tall girl."
"Who can tell in this angle? I can't tell anything except he has a suit on." Okay, there they go, toward the conference room.
As they approached the room, she suddenly began to struggle.
"Oops," Graham said, "she's unhappy again. Moody young thing, isn't she?"
The man gripped her tightly and she spun, trying to twist free. He half carried her, half dragged her to the room. At the doorway, she spun a final time, grabbed the door frame, struggling.
"She lose the purse there?"
"Probably. I can't see clearly." The conference room was located directly opposite the camera, so we had a view of the entire room. But the interior of the conference room was very dark, so the two people were silhouetted against the lights of the skyscrapers through the outer glass windows. The man lifted her up in his arms and set her down on the table, rolled her onto her back. She became passive, liquid, as he slid her skirt up her hips. She seemed to be accepting, moving to meet him. And then he made a quick movement between their bodies, and suddenly something flew away.
"There go the panties."
It looked as if they landed on the floor, but it was hard to tell for sure. If they were panties, they were black, or some other dark color. So much, I thought, for Senator Rowe.
"The panties were gone by the time we got there," Graham said, staring at the monitor. "Fucking withholding of evidence, pure and simple."
He rubbed his hands together.
"You got any Nakamoto stock, buddy, I'd sell it, because it isn't going to be worth shit by tomorrow afternoon."
On the screen, she was still welcoming him, and he was fumbling with his zipper, when suddenly she tried to sit up and slapped him hard in the face. Graham said,
"There we go, a little spice."
The man grabbed her hands and tried to kiss her, but she resisted him, turning her face away. He pushed her back on the table. He leaned his weight on her body, holding her there. Her bare legs kicked and churned. The two silhouettes merged and separated. It was difficult to determine exactly what was happening. It looked as if Cheryl kept trying to sit up and the man kept shoving her back. He held her down, one hand on her upper chest, while her legs kicked at him and her body twisted on the table. He still held her on the table, but the whole scene was more arduous than arousing. As it continued, I had trouble with the image I was seeing. Was this a genuine rape, or was she play-acting? After all, she kept kicking and struggling, but she wasn't succeeding in pushing him away. The man might be stronger than she was, but I had the feeling that she could have kicked him back if she had really wanted to. And sometimes it looked as if her arms were locked around his neck instead of trying to push him away. But it was difficult to know for sure when we were seeing... Uh-oh. Trouble. The man stopped his rhythmic pumping. Beneath him, Cheryl went limp. Her arms slid away from his shoulders, dropped back on the table. Her legs fell slack on either side of him. Graham said,
"Is that it? Did it just happen?"
"I can't tell." The man patted her cheek, then shook her more vigorously. He seemed to be talking to her. He remained there for a while, maybe 30 seconds, and then he slipped away from her body. She stayed on the table. He walked around her. He was moving slowly, as if he could not believe it. Then he looked off to the left, as if he had heard a sound. He stood frozen for a moment, and then he seemed to make up his mind. He went into action, moving around the room, looking in a methodical way. He picked up something from the floor.
The panties. "He took them himself," Graham said. "Shit."
Now the man moved around the girl and bent briefly over her body on the far side.
"What's he doing there?"
"I don't know. I can't see."
"Shit."
The man straightened and moved away from the conference room, back into the atrium. He was no longer silhouetted. There was a chance we could identify him. But he was looking back into the conference room, back at the dead girl.
"Hey, buddy, Graham said, talking to the image on the monitor.
Look over here, buddy. Come on, just for a minute.
On the screen, the man continued to look at the dead girl as he took several more steps into the atrium. Then he began to walk quickly away to the left.
He's not going back to the elevators, I said.
No,
but I can't see his face. Where is he going?
There's a stairwell at the far end, Graham said. Fire exit.
Why is he going there, instead of the elevator?
Who knows? I just want to see his face, just once. But now the man was to the far left of our camera, and even though he was no longer turned away, we could see only his left ear and cheekbone. He walked quickly. Soon he would be gone from our view, beneath the ceiling overhang at the far end of the room.
Ah, shit, this angle's no good. Let's look at another tape.
Just a minute, I said. Our man was moving toward a dark passageway that must lead to the staircase. But as he went, he passed a decorative gilt-frame mirror hanging on the wall right by the passage. He passed it just as he went under the overhang into final darkness.
There. How do you stop this thing?
I was pressing buttons on the player frantically. I finally found the one that stopped it.
We went back, then forward again.
Again, the man moved purposefully toward the dark passage with long, quick strides. He moved past the mirror, and for an instant, a single video frame, we could see his face reflected in the mirror, see it clearly, and I pressed the button to freeze the frame.
Benko, I said.
A fucking Jap, Graham said, just like I told you. Frozen in the mirror was the face of the killer as he strode toward the stairwell. I had no trouble recognizing the tense features of Eddie Sakamura.
This one is mine, Graham said. It's my case. I'm going to go bring the bastard in.
Sure, Connor said. I mean, Graham said, I'd rather go alone.
Of course, Connor said. It's your case, Tom. Do whatever you think best.
Connor wrote down Eddie Sakamura's address for him.
It's not that I don't appreciate your help, Graham said, but I'd rather handle it myself.
Now, just so I have my facts straight, you guys talked to this guy earlier tonight, and you didn't bring him in?
That's right.
Well, don't worry about it, Graham said. I'll bury that in the report. It won't come back to you, I promise you. Graham was in a magnanimous mood, pleased at the prospect of arresting Sakamura. He glanced at his watch.
Fucking A, less than 6 hours since the original call. And we already have the murderer. Not bad.
We don't have the murderer quite yet, Connor said. I'd bring him in right away, if I were you.
I'm leaving now, Graham said.
Oh, and Tom, Connor said, as Graham headed toward the door.
Eddie Sakamura is a strange guy, but he's not known to be violent. I doubt very much that he's armed. He probably doesn't even own a gun. He went home from the party with a redhead. He's probably in bed with her now. I think it would be advisable to bring him in alive.
Hey, Graham said, what is it with you two?
Just a suggestion, Connor said.
You really think I'm going to shoot this little shithead?
You'll go out there with a couple of black and whites for backup, won't you? Connor said. The patrolman might be excitable. I'm just giving you the background.
Hey, thanks for your fucking support, Graham said, and he left. He was so broad, he had to turn slightly sideways to go through the door. I watched him go.
Why are you letting him do this alone?
Connor shrugged. It's his case.
But you've been aggressive all night in pursuing his case. Why stop now?
Connor said, let Graham have the glory. After all, what has it got to do with us? I'm a cop on extended leave, and you're just a corrupt liaison officer. He pointed to the videotape.
You want to run that for me before you give me a ride home?
Sure. I rewound the tape.
I was thinking we could get a cup of coffee, too, Connor said. They make a good one in the SID labs. At least they used to.
I said, you want me to get coffee while you look at the tape?
That would be nice, Kohai, Connor said.
Sure. I started the tape for him and turned to leave.
Oh, and Kohai, while you're down there, ask the night duty officer what facilities the department has for videotapes. Because all these need to be duplicated. and we may need hard copies of individual frames, especially if there's trouble about Sakamura's arrest as Japan bashing by the department. We may need to release a picture to defend ourselves. It was a good point. Okay, I said, I'll check. And I take mine black with one sugar. He turned to look at the monitor. The Scientific Investigation Division, or SID, was in the basement of Parker Center. It was after 2 a.m. when I got there, and most of the sections were closed down. SID was pretty much a 9-to-5 operation. Of course, the teams worked at night collecting evidence from crime scenes, but the evidence was then stored in lockers, either downtown or at one of the divisions, until the next morning. I went to the coffee machine and the little cafeteria next to Latent Prince. All around the room were signs reading, "Did you wash your hands? This means you," and "Don't expose fellow officers to risk. Wash your hands." The reason was that the SID teams used poisons, especially criminalistics. There was so much mercury, arsenic, and chromium floating around that in the old days, officers had sometimes gotten sick by drinking from a styrofoam cup that another lab worker had merely touched. But these days people were more careful. I got 2 cups of coffee and went back to the night duty desk. Jackie Levine was on duty with her feet up on the desk. She was a heavy-set woman wearing toreador pants and an orange wig. Despite her bizarre appearance, she was widely acknowledged to be the best print lifter in the department. She was reading Modern Ride magazine. I said, "You going to do it again, Jackie?" "Hell no," she said. "My daughter." "Who's she marrying?" "Let's talk about something happy," she said. "One of those coffees for me?" "Sorry," I said, "but I have a question for you. Who handles videotape evidence here?"
"Videotape evidence?"
"Like tape from surveillance cameras.
Who analyzes it? Makes hard copies, all that?"
"Well, we don't get much call for that," Jackie said. "Electronics used to do it here, but I think they gave it up. Nowadays, video either goes to Valley or Medler Hall." She sat forward, thumbed through a directory. "If you want, you can talk to Bill Harrelson over at Medler. But if it's anything special, I think we farm it out to JPL or the Advanced Imaging Lab at USC. You want the contact numbers, or you want to go through Harrelson?" Something in her tone told me what to do. "Maybe I'll take the contact numbers."
"Yeah, I would."
I wrote the numbers down and went back up to the division. Connor had finished the tape and was running it back and forth at the point where Sakamura's face appeared in the mirror. "Well," I said, "that's Eddie, all right." He appeared calm, almost indifferent. He took the coffee from me and sipped it.
"Terrible."
"Yeah, I know.
It used to be better."
Connor set the cup aside, turned off the video recorder, stood and stretched. "Well, I think we've done a good evening's work. What do you say we get some sleep? I have a big golf game in the morning at Sunset Hills." "Okay," I said. I packed the tapes back in the cardboard box and set the VCR carefully in the box, too. Connor said, "What are you going to do with those tapes?"
"I'll put them in the evidence locker."
Connor said, "These are the originals, and we don't have duplicates." "I know, but I can't get dupes made until tomorrow."
"Exactly my point. Why don't you keep them with you?"
"Take them home?" There were all sorts of departmental injunctions about taking evidence home. It was against the rules, to put it mildly. He shrugged. "I wouldn't leave this to chance. Take the tapes with you, and then you can arrange the duplication yourself, tomorrow." I stuck them under my arm. I said, "You don't think anybody at the department would..."
"Of course not," Connor said. "But this evidence is crucial, and we wouldn't want anybody to walk by the evidence locker with a big magnet while we were asleep, would we?"
So in the end, I took the tapes. As we went out the door, we passed Ishigara, still sitting there, contrite. Connor said something quickly to him in Japanese. Ishigara jumped to his feet, bowed quickly, and scurried out of the office.
"Is he really so scared?"
"Yes," Connor said. Ishigara moved quickly down the hall ahead of us, head bent low.
He seemed almost a caricature of a mousy, frightened man.
"Why?"
I said. "He's lived here long enough to know that any case we might have against him for withholding evidence is not strong. And we have even less of a case against Nakamoto."
"That's not the point," Connor said. "He's not worried about legalities. He's worried about scandal, because that's what would happen if we were in Japan."
We came around the corner. Ishigara was standing by the banks of elevators, waiting.
We waited, too. There was an awkward moment. The first elevator came, and Ishigara stepped away for us to get on. The doors closed on him, bowing to us in the lobby. The elevator started down. Connor said, "In Japan, he and his company could be finished forever."
"Why?"
"Because in Japan, scandal is the most common way of revising the pecking order, of getting rid of a powerful opponent. It's a routine procedure over there. You uncover a vulnerability, and you leak it to the press or to government investigators. A scandal inevitably follows, and a person or organization is ruined. That's how the recruit scandal brought down Takeshita as prime minister. Or the financial scandals brought down Prime Minister Tanaka in the 70s. It's the same way the Japanese screwed General Electric a couple of years ago."
"They screwed General Electric?"
"In the Yokogawa scandal. You heard of it?"
"No."
"Well, it's classic Japanese maneuvering. A few years ago, General Electric made the best scanning equipment in the world for hospitals. GE formed a subsidiary, Yokogawa Medical, to market this equipment in Japan. And GE did business the Japanese way, cutting costs below competitors to get market share, providing excellent service and support, entertaining customers, giving potential buyers air tickets and traveler's checks. We'd call it bribes, but it's standard business procedure in Japan. Yokogawa quickly became the market leader, ahead of Japanese companies like Toshiba. The Japanese companies didn't like that and complained about unfairness. And one day, government agents raided Yokogawa's offices and found evidence of the bribes. They arrested several Yokogawa employees and blackened the company name in scandal. It didn't hurt GE sales in Japan very much. It didn't matter that other Japanese companies also offer bribes. For some reason, it was the non-Japanese company that got caught. Amazing how that happens."
I said, "Is it really that bad?"
"The Japanese can be tough," Connor said. "They say business is war, and they mean it. You know how Japan is always telling us that their markets are open? Well, in the old days, if a Japanese bought an American car, he got audited by the government. So pretty soon, nobody bought an American car. The officials shrug. What can they do? Their market is open. They can't help it if nobody wants an American car. The obstructions are endless. Every imported car has to be individually tested on the dock to make sure it complies with exhaust emission laws. Foreign drugs can only be tested in Japanese laboratories on Japanese nationals. Foreign skis were once banned because Japanese snow was said to be wetter than European and American snow. That's the way they treat other countries, so it's not surprising they worry about getting a taste of their own medicine."
"Then Ishigara is waiting for some scandal?
Because that's what would happen in Japan?"
"Yes, he's afraid that Nakamoto will be finished in a single stroke."
"But I doubt that it will. Chances are, it'll be business as usual in Los Angeles tomorrow."
I drove Connor back to his apartment. As he climbed out of the car, I said,
"Well, it's been interesting, Captain. Thanks for spending the time with me."
"You're welcome," Connor said. "Call me anytime, if you need help in the future. I hope your golf game isn't too early tomorrow."
"Actually, it's at 7, but at my age I don't need much sleep. I'll be playing at the Sunset Hills."
"Isn't it a Japanese course?"
The purchase of the Sunset Hills Country Club was one of the more recent outrages in L.A. The West Los Angeles golf course was bought for a huge cash price, $200 million in 1990. At the time, the new Japanese owners said no changes would be made. But now, the American membership was slowly being reduced by a simple procedure.
Whenever an American retired, his place was offered to a Japanese. Sunset Hill's memberships were sold in Tokyo for $1 million each, where they were considered a bargain. There was a long waiting list. "Well," Connor said, "I'm playing with some Japanese."
"You do that often?"
"The Japanese are avid golfers, as you know. I try to play twice a week. Sometimes you hear things of interest." "Good night, Kohai."
"Good night, Captain."
I drove home. I was pulling onto the Santa Monica freeway when the phone rang. It was the DHD operator.
"Lieutenant, we have a special services call. Officers in the field request assistance of the liaison."
I sighed.
"Okay."
She gave me the mobile number. "Hey, buddy." It was Graham. I said, "Hi, Tom."
"You alone yet?"
"Yeah, I'm heading home. Why?"
"I was thinking," Graham said, "maybe we should have the Japanese liaison on hand for this bust."
"I thought you wanted to do it alone."
"Yeah, well, maybe you want to come over and help out with this bust, just so everything is done by the book."
I said, "Is this a CYA?
I meant, cover your ass.
Hey, you going to help me out or not?"
"Sure, Tom. I'm on my way."
"We'll wait for you." Eddie Sakamura lived in a small house on one of those narrow, twisting streets high in the Hollywood Hills above the 101 freeway. It was 2:45 a.m. when I came around a curve and saw the two black and whites with their lights off and Graham's tan sedan parked to one side. Graham was standing with the patrolman, smoking a cigarette. I had to go back a dozen meters to find a place to park. Then I walked over to them. We looked up at Eddie's house, built over a garage at street level. It was one of those two-bedroom white stucco houses from the 1940s. The lights were on, and we heard Frank Sinatra singing. Graham said, "He's not alone. He's got some broads up there." I said, "How do you want to handle it?" Graham said, "We leave the boys here. I told them no shooting. Don't worry. You and I go up and make the bust." Steep stairs ran up from the garage to the house.
"Okay, you take the front and I'll take the back?"
"Hell no," Graham said. "I want you with me, buddy. He's not dangerous, right?"
I saw the silhouette of a woman pass one of the windows. She looked naked.
"Shouldn't be," I said.
"Okay, then, let's do it." We started up the stairs single file. Frank Sinatra was singing My Way. We heard the laughter of women. It sounded like more than one.
"Christ, I hope they got some fucking drugs out."
I thought the chances of that were pretty good. We reached the top of the stairs, ducking to avoid being seen through the windows. The front door was Spanish, heavy and solid. Graham paused. I moved a few steps toward the back of the house, where I saw the greenish glow of pool lights. There was probably a back door going out to the pool. I was trying to see where it was. Graham tapped my shoulder. I came back. He gently turned the handle of the front door. It was unlocked. Graham took out his revolver and looked at me. I took out my gun. He paused, held up three fingers. Count of three. Graham kicked the front door open and went in low, shouting, "Hold it, police! Hold it right there!" Before I got into the living room, I could hear the women screaming. There were two of them, completely naked, running around the room and shrieking at the top of their lungs, "Eddie! Eddie!" Eddie wasn't there. Graham was shouting, "Where is he? Where is Eddie Sakamura?" The redhead grabbed a pillow from the couch to cover herself and screamed, "Get out of here, you fucker!" And then she threw the pillow at Graham. The other girl, a blonde, ran squealing into the bedroom. We followed her, and the redhead threw another pillow at us. In the bedroom, the blonde fell on the floor and howled in pain. Graham leaned over her with his gun.
"Don't shoot me," she cried. "I didn't do anything."
Graham grabbed her by the ankle. There was all this twisting bare flesh. The girl was hysterical.
"Where is Eddie?" Graham said. "Where is he?"
"In a meeting,"
the girl squealed.
"Where?"
"In a meeting."
And flailing around, she kicked Graham in the nuts with her other leg.
"Oh, Christ,"
Graham said, letting the girl go. He coughed and sat down hard. I went back to the living room. The redhead had her high heels on, but nothing else. I said, "Where is he?"
"You bastards," she said. "You fucking bastards."
I went past her toward a door at the far end of the room. It was locked. The redhead ran up and began to hit me on the back with her fists.
"Leave him alone! Leave him alone!"
I was trying to open the locked door while she pounded on me. I thought I heard voices from the other side of the door. In the next moment, Graham's big bulk slammed into the door and the wood splintered. The door opened. I saw the kitchen, lit by the green light of the pool outside. The room was empty. The back door was open.
Shit.
By now the redhead had jumped on my back and locked her legs around my waist. She was pulling my hair, screaming obscenities. I spun around in circles, trying to throw her off me. It was one of those strange moments where in the middle of all the chaos I was thinking, "Be careful, don't hurt her," because it would look bad for a pretty young girl to end up with a broken arm or cracked ribs. It would mean police brutality, even though right now she was tearing my hair out by the roots. She bit my ear and I felt pain. I slammed myself back against the wall, and I heard her grunt as the breath was knocked out of her. She let go. Out the window, I saw a dark figure running down the stairs. Graham saw it too. "Fuck," he said. He ran. I ran too. But the girl must have tripped me because I fell over, landing hard. When I got to my feet, I heard the sirens of the Black and Whites and their engines starting up. Then I was back outside, running down the steps. I was maybe 10 meters behind Graham, about 30 feet, when Eddie's Ferrari backed out of the garage, ground the gears, and roared down the street. The Black and Whites immediately took up pursuit. Graham ran for his sedan. He had pulled out to follow while I was still running for my own car, parked farther down the road. As his car flashed past me, I could see his face, grim and angry. I got into my car and followed. You can't drive fast in the hills and talk on the phone. I didn't even try. I estimated I was half a kilometer behind Graham, and he was some distance behind the two patrol cars. When I got to the bottom of the hill, the 101 overpass, I saw the flashing lights going down the freeway. I had to back up and pull around to the entrance below Mulholland, and then I joined traffic heading south. When the traffic began to slow up, I stuck my flasher on the roof and pulled into the right-hand breakdown lane. I got to the concrete embankment about 30 seconds after the Ferrari hit it flat out at 160 kilometers an hour. I guessed the gas tank had exploded on impact, and the flames were jumping 15 meters into the air. The heat was tremendous. It looked like the trees up on the hill might catch fire. You couldn't get anywhere near the twisted wreck of the car. The first of the fire trucks pulled up with three more Black and Whites. There were sirens and flashing lights everywhere. I backed up my car to make room for the trucks, then walked over to Graham. He smoked a cigarette as the fireman began to spray the wreck with foam. "Christ," Graham said. "What a fucking cock-up." "Why didn't the backup patrolman stop him when he was in the garage?" "Because," Graham said, "I told them not to shoot at him. And we weren't there. They were trying to decide what to do when the guy drove away." He shook his head. "This is going to look like shit in the report." I said, "Still, it's probably better you didn't shoot him." "Maybe." He ground out his cigarette. By now the firemen had gotten the fire out. The Ferrari was a smoking hulk crumpled against the concrete. There was a harsh smell in the air. "Well," Graham said, "no point staying around here. I'll go back up to the house, see if those girls are still there." "You need me for anything else?" "No, you might as well go. Tomorrow is another day." "Shit, it'll be paperwork until we drop." He looked at me. He hesitated. "We in sync about this? About what happened?" "Hell yes," I said. "No way to handle it differently," he said, "far as I can see." "No," I said, "just one of those things." "Okay, buddy, see you tomorrow. Good night, Tom." We got into our cars. I drove home. Mrs. Asenio was snoring loudly on the sofa. It was 3:45 in the morning. I tiptoed past her and looked in Michelle's room. My daughter lay on her back, her covers tossed aside, her arms flung over her head. Her feet stuck through the bars of the crib. I tucked the covers around her and went into my own room. The television was still on. I turned it off. I pulled off my tie and sat down on the bed to remove my shoes. I suddenly realized how tired I was. I took off my coat and trousers and threw them onto the television set. I lay down on my back and thought I should take off my shirt. It felt sweaty and grimy on my body. I closed my eyes for a moment and let my head sink back into the pillow. Then I felt a pinching, a something tugging at my eyeballs. I heard a chirping sound and thought in a moment of horror that birds were pecking at my eyes. I heard a voice saying, "Open your eyes, Daddy, open your eyes." And I realized that it was my daughter trying to pull my eyelids up with small fingers. "Yeah," I said. I glimpsed daylight, rolled away, and buried my face in the pillow.
"Daddy, open your eyes. Open your eyes, Daddy."
I said, "Daddy was out late last night. Daddy is tired." She paid no attention.
"Daddy, open your eyes. Open your eyes. Daddy, open your eyes, Daddy."
I knew that she would continue saying the same thing over and over until I lost my mind or opened my eyes. I rolled onto my back and coughed.
"Daddy is still tired, Shelley. Go see what Mrs. Asenio is doing."
"Daddy, open your eyes."
"Can't you let Daddy sleep a while? Daddy wants to sleep a little longer this morning."
"It's morning now, Daddy. Open your eyes. Open your eyes."
I opened my eyes. She was right. It was morning. What the hell? Second day.
"Eat your pancakes. I don't want any more."
"Just one more bite, Shelley."
Sunlight streamed through the kitchen window. I yawned. It was 7 o'clock in the morning.
"Is Mommy coming today?"
"Don't change the subject. Come on, Shell, one more bite, please."
We were sitting at her kid-sized table in the corner of the kitchen. Sometimes I can get her to eat at the little table when she won't eat at the big table. But I wasn't having much luck today. Michelle stared at me.
"Is Mommy coming?"
"I think so. I'm not sure."
I didn't want to disappoint her.
"We're waiting to hear."
"Is Mommy going out of town again?"
I said, "Maybe." I wondered what "going out of town" meant to a two-year-old. What sort of image she would have of it.
"Is she going with Uncle Rick?"
"Who is Uncle Rick?"
I held the fork in front of my face.
"I don't know, Shell. Come on, open up.
One more bite." "He has a new car,"
Michelle said, nodding solemnly, the way she did whenever she was informing me of important news.
"Is that right?"
"Uh-huh. Black one."
"I see. What kind of car is it?"
"Sadie's."
"A Sadie's?"
"No. Sadie's."
"You mean Mercedes?"
"Uh-huh. Black one."
"That's nice," I said.
"When is Mommy coming?"
"One more bite, Shell."
She opened her mouth, and I moved the fork toward her. At the last moment, she turned her head aside, pursing her lips.
"No, Daddy."
"All right," I said. "I give up."
"I'm not hungry, Daddy."
"I can see that."
Mrs. Asenio was cleaning up the kitchen before she went back to her own apartment. There was another 15 minutes before my housekeeper, Elaine, came to take Michelle to daycare. I still had to get her dressed. I was putting her pancakes in the sink when the phone rang. It was Ellen Farley, the mayor's press aide.
"Are you watching?"
"Watching what?"
"The news, Channel 7. They're doing the car crash right now."
"They are?"
"Call me back," she said.
I went into the bedroom and turned on the television. A voice was saying, "Reported a high-speed chase on the Hollywood Freeway southbound, which ended when the suspect drove his Ferrari sports car into the Vine Street overpass, not far from the Hollywood Bowl. Observers say the car hit the concrete embankment at more than 100 miles an hour, instantly bursting into flames. Fire trucks were called to the scene, but there were no survivors. The driver's body was so badly burned that his glasses melted. The officer in charge of the pursuit, Detective Thomas Graham, said that the driver, Mr. Edward Sakamura, was wanted in connection with the alleged murder of a woman at a downtown location.
But today, friends of Mr. Sakamura expressed disbelief at this charge and claimed that police strong-arm tactics panicked the suspect and caused him to flee. There are complaints that the incident was racially motivated. It is not clear whether police intended to charge Mr. Sakamura with the murder, and observers noted that this was the third high-speed pursuit on the 101 freeway in the last 2 weeks. Questions of police judgment in these pursuits have arisen after a Compton woman was killed in a high-speed pursuit last January. Neither Detective Graham nor his assistant, Lieutenant Peter Smith, was available to be interviewed, and we are waiting to hear if the officers will be disciplined or suspended by the department.
Jesus.
Daddy?
Just a minute, Shell.
The image showed the crumpled, smoking wreckage being loaded onto a flatbed truck for removal from the side of the highway. There was a black smear on the concrete where the car had struck the wall. The station cut back to the studio, where the anchor woman faced the camera and said,
"In other developments, KNBC has learned that two police officers interviewed Mr. Sakamura earlier in the evening in connection with the case, but did not arrest him at that time. Captain John Connor and Lieutenant Smith may face disciplinary review by the department, with questions being raised of possible procedural violations. However, the good news is there are no longer delays for traffic moving southbound on the 101. Now over to you, Bob."
I stared numbly at the TV. Disciplinary review?
The phone rang. It was Ellen Farley again.
"You get all that?"
"Yeah, I did. I can't believe it. What's it about, Ellen?"
"None of this is coming from the mayor's office, if that's what you're asking. But the Japanese community has been unhappy with Graham before. They think he's a racist. It looks like he played right into their hands."
"I was there. Graham acted correctly."
"Yeah, I know you were there, Pete. Frankly, it's unfortunate. I don't want to see you tarred by the same brush."
I said, "Graham acted correctly."
"Are you listening, Pete?"
"What about this suspension and disciplinary review?"
"That's the first I heard of it," Ellen said. "But that would be internally generated. It's coming from your own department. By the way, is it true? Did you and Connor see Sakamura last night?"
"Yes."
"And you didn't arrest him?"
"No, we didn't have probable cause to arrest him when we talked to him. Later on, we did."
Ellen said, "Do you really think he could have done this murder?"
"I know he did. We have it on tape."
"On tape? Are you serious?"
"Yeah, we have the murder on videotape from one of the Nakamoto security cameras."
She was silent for a while. I said, "Ellen?"
"Look," Ellen said, "off the record, okay?"
"Sure."
"I don't know what's going on here, Pete. There's more than I understand."
"Why didn't you tell me who the girl was last night?"
"I'm sorry about that. I had a lot to take care of."
"Ellen."
A silence. Then,
"Pete, this girl got around. She knew a lot of people."
"Did she know the mayor?"
Silence.
"How well did she know him?"
"Listen," Ellen said, "let's just say she was a pretty girl and she knew a lot of people in this town. Personally, I thought she was unbalanced, but she was good-looking and she had a hell of an effect on men. You had to see it to believe it. Now there's a lot of irons in the fire. You saw the Times today?"
"No."
"Take a look. If you ask me, you want to be very correct the next couple of days. Dot your I's and cross your T's. Do everything by the book. And watch your back, okay?"
"Okay. Thanks, Ellen."
"Don't thank me. I didn't call."
Then her voice got softer.
"Take care of yourself, Peter."
I heard a dial tone.
"Daddy?"
"Just a minute, Shell."
"Can I watch cartoons?"
"Sure, honey."
I found her a station with some cartoons and walked into the living room. I opened the front door and picked up the Times from the mat. It took me a while to find the story on the last page of the Metro section. "Charges of police racism cloud Japanese fete." I skimmed the first paragraph. Japanese officials of the Nakamoto Corporation complained about callous and insensitive police behavior
which they said detracted from a star-studded opening night at their new skyscraper on Figueroa. At least one Nakamoto official expressed the view that the police actions were racially motivated. A spokesperson said, "We do not believe the Los Angeles Police Department would behave in this fashion if a Japanese corporation were not involved. We feel strongly that the actions of the police reflect a double standard for treatment of Japanese at the hands of American officials." Mr. Hiroshi Ogura, chairman of the board of Nakamoto, was present at the party, which drew such celebrities as Madonna and Tom Cruise, but he could not be reached for comment on the incident. A spokesman said, "Mr. Ogura is deeply disturbed that official hostility should mar this gathering. He very much regrets the unpleasantness that occurred." According to observers, Mayor Thomas sent a staff member to deal with the police, but with little result. The police did not modify their behavior, despite the presence of the special Japanese liaison officer, Lieutenant Peter Smith, whose job is to defuse racially sensitive situations. And so on. You had to read four paragraphs before you discovered that a murder had occurred. That particular detail seemed to be almost irrelevant. I looked back at the lead. The story was from the City News Service, which meant there was no byline. I felt angry enough to call my old contact at the Times, Kenny Shubik. Ken was the leading Metro reporter. He had been at the paper forever, and he knew everything that was going on. Since it was still 8 in the morning, I called him at home. "Ken, Pete Smith." "Oh, hi," he said. "Glad you got my message." In the background, I heard what sounded like a teenage girl.
"Oh, come on, Dad. Why can't I go?"
Ken said, "Jennifer, let me talk here for a minute."
"What message?"
I said. Ken said, "I called you last night because I thought you ought to know right away. He's obviously working off a tip. But do you have any idea what's behind it?"
"Behind what?"
I said. I didn't know what he was talking about.
"I'm sorry, Ken. I didn't get your message."
"Really?" he said. "I called you about 11:30 last night. The DHD dispatcher said you had rolled out on a case, but you had a car phone. I told her it was important and for you to call me at home if necessary, because I felt sure you'd want to know." In the background, the girl said,
"Dad, come on. I have to decide what to wear."
"Jennifer, damn it," he said, "chill out." To me, he said, "You have a daughter, don't you?"
"Yeah," I said, "but she's only 2.
"Just wait," Ken said. "Look, Pete, you really didn't get my message?"
"No,"
I said. "I'm calling about something else. The story in this morning's paper."
"What story?"
"The Nakamoto coverage on page 8. The one about callous and racist police at the opening."
"Geez, I didn't think we had a Nakamoto story yesterday.
I know Jody was doing the party, but that won't run until tomorrow. You know, Japan draws the glitterati. Jeff didn't have anything on the skeds in Metro yesterday."
Jeff was the Metro editor. I said, "There's a story in the paper this morning about the murder."
"What murder?"
he said. His voice sounded odd. "There was a murder at Nakamoto last night, about 8:30. One of the guests was killed."
Ken was silent at the other end of the line, putting things together. Finally, he said, "Were you involved?"
"Homicide called me in as Japanese liaison."
"Hmm," Ken said. "Listen, let me get to my desk and see what I can find out. Let's talk in an hour. And give me your numbers so I can call you direct."
"Okay."
He cleared his throat. "Listen, Pete," he said, "just between us. Do you have any problems?"
"Like what?"
"Like a morals problem, or a problem with your bank account, discrepancy about reported income, anything I should know about, as your friend?"
"No,"
I said.
"I don't need the details, but if there's something that isn't quite right..."
"Nothing, Ken. 'Cause if I have to go to bat for you, I don't want to discover I have stepped in shit."
"Ken, what's going on?"
"I don't want to get into detail right now, but offhand I would say somebody is trying to fuck you in the ass," Ken said. The girl said,
"Daddy, that's disgusting."
"Well, you're not supposed to be listening."
Pete?
Yeah, I said. I'm here.
Call me in an hour, Ken said.
You're a pal, I said. I owe you.
Fucking right you do, Ken said.
He hung up.
I looked around the apartment. Everything still looked the same. Morning sunlight was still streaming into the room. Michelle was sitting in her favorite chair, watching cartoons and sucking her thumb. But somehow everything felt different. It was creepy. It was like the world had tilted. But I had things to do. It was also getting late. I had to get her dressed before Elaine came to take her to daycare. I told her that. She started to cry. So I turned off the television set, and she threw herself on the floor and began to kick and scream.
No, Daddy. Cartoons, Daddy.
I picked her up and slung her underarm to the bedroom to get her changed. She was screaming at the top of her lungs. The phone rang again. This time it was the division dispatcher.
Morning, Lieutenant. I have your uncleared messages.
Let me get a pencil, I said. I put Michelle down. She cried even louder. I said, can you go pick out which shoes you want to wear today?
Sounds like you got a murder there, the dispatcher said.
She doesn't want to get dressed for school. Michelle was tugging at my leg.
No, Daddy, no school, Daddy.
Yes, school, I said firmly. She bawled.
Go ahead, I said to the dispatcher.
Okay, 11:41 last night. You had a call from a Ken Subotic or Subotnik. L.A. Times. He said please call him. Message reads, the weasel is checking up on you. He said you would know what that meant. You can call him at home. You have the number?
Yes.
Okay, 1:42 a.m. this morning, you had a call from Mr. Eddie Saka. Looks like Sakamura. He said it's urgent. Please call him at home. 555-8434. It's about the missing tape. Okay?
Shit. I said, what time was that call?
1:42 a.m. The call was forwarded to County General, and I guess their switchboard couldn't locate you. You were at the morgue or something?
Yeah.
Sorry, Lieutenant, but once you're out of your car, we have to go through intermediates.
Okay. Anything else?
Then at 6:43 a.m., Captain Connor left a beeper number for you to call. He said he's playing golf this morning.
Okay.
And at 7:10, we had a call from Robert Woodson, who is with Senator Morton's office. Senator Morton wants to meet you and Captain Connor at 1 o'clock today at the Los Angeles Country Club. He asked that you call and confirm that you will attend the meeting with the senator. I tried to reach you, but your phone was busy. Will you call the senator?
I said I would call the senator.
I told the dispatcher to page Connor for me at the golf course and have him call me in the car. I heard the front door unlock. Elaine came in.
Good morning, she said.
I'm afraid Shelley isn't dressed yet.
That's okay, she said. I'll do it. What time is Mrs. Davis coming to pick her up?
We're waiting to hear.
Elaine had been through this routine many times before. Come on, Michelle, let's pick your clothes for today. Time to get ready for school.
I looked at my watch and was on my way to get another cup of coffee when the phone rang.
Lieutenant Peter Smith, please.
It was the assistant chief, Jim Olson.
Hi, Jim.
Morning, Pete.
He sounded friendly, but Jim Olson never called anybody before 10 o'clock in the morning unless there was a big problem. Olson said,
looks like we got ourselves a rattlesnake by the tail. You see the papers today?
Yeah, I did.
You happen to catch the morning news?
Some of it.
The chief's been calling me for damage control. I wanted to get where you stand before I make a recommendation.
Okay?
Okay. I just got off the phone with Tom Graham. He admits last night was a prime screw-up. Nobody is covered in glory.
I'm afraid not.
A couple of naked broads impeded two able-bodied police officers and prevented apprehension of the suspect? Is that about it?
It sounded ridiculous.
I said, you had to be there, Jim.
Uh-huh, he said. Well, one good thing so far. I've been checking if correct pursuit procedures were followed. Apparently they were. We have recordings off the computers, and we have voice recordings off the radio, and it's all strictly by the book. Thank God. Nobody even swears. We can release those records to the media if this thing gets any worse. So we're covered there. But it's very unfortunate that Sakamura is dead.
Yes.
Graham went back to get the girls, but the house was deserted. The girls were gone.
I see.
In all the rush, nobody got the names of the girls?
No, I'm afraid not.
That means we have no witnesses to the events in the house. So we're a little vulnerable.
Uh-huh.
They're cutting Sakamura's body out of the wreck this morning to ship what's left to the morgue. Graham tells me, as far as he's concerned, the case is wrapped up. I gather there are videotapes that show Sakamura killed the girl. Graham says he is ready to file his concluding 579 report. Is that how you see it? The case closed?
I guess so, Chief. Sure.
Then we can shut this fucker down, the chief said. The Japanese community finds the Nakamoto inquiry irritating and offensive. They don't want it to continue any longer than necessary. So if we can call it a day, it would help.
It's okay with me, I said.
Let's call it a day.
Well, that's good, Pete, the chief said.
I'm going to speak to the chief, see if we can head off any disciplinary action.
Thanks, Jim.
Try not to worry. Myself, I don't see a disciplinary issue. As long as we have videos that show Sakamura did it.
Yeah, we do.
About those videos, he said. I've had Marty looking in the evidence locker. He can't seem to find them. I took a deep breath and said,
No, I have them.
You didn't log them in the evidence locker last night?
No, I wanted to get copies made.
He coughed.
Pete, it'd be better if you had followed procedure on that.
I wanted to get copies made, I said.
Tell you what, Jim said. Get your copies made and get the originals onto my desk by 10 o'clock, okay?
Okay. It can take that long to locate the material from the evidence locker. You know how it is.
He was saying he would cover for me.
Thanks, Jim.
Don't thank me because I didn't do anything, he said. Far as I know, procedure has been followed.
Right. But just between you and me, get it done right away. I can hold the fort for a couple of hours. Something's going on down here. I don't know exactly where it's coming from. So don't push it, okay?
Okay, Jim. I'm on my way now.
I hung up the phone and went to get copies made. Pasadena looked like a city at the bottom of a glass of sour milk. The Jet Propulsion Laboratory, on the outskirts of town, was nestled in the foothills near the Rose Bowl. But even at 8:30 in the morning, you couldn't see the mountains through the yellow-white haze. I tucked the box of tapes under my arm, showed my badge, signed the guard's clipboard, and swore I was an American citizen. The guard sent me to the main building across an inner courtyard. For decades, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory had served as the command center for American spacecraft that photographed Jupiter and the rings of Saturn and sent pictures back to Earth as video images. JPL was the place where modern video image processing had been invented. If anybody could copy these tapes, they could. Mary Jane Kelleher, the press secretary, took me up to the third floor. We walked down a lime-green corridor, past several doors that opened into empty offices. I mentioned it.
It's true, she said, nodding. We've been losing some good people, Peter.
Where are they going? I said.
Mostly to industry.
We always lost a few to IBM in Armonk, or Bell Labs in New Jersey. But those labs don't have the best equipment or funding anymore. Now it's the Japanese research labs like Hitachi in Long Beach, Sanyo in Torrance, Canon in Inglewood. They're hiring a lot of American researchers now.
Is JPL concerned about it?
Sure, she said. Everybody knows the best way to transfer technology is inside somebody's head. But what can you do?
She shrugged.
Researchers want to do research, and America doesn't do so much R&D anymore. Budgets are tighter, so it's better to work for the Japanese. They pay well, and they genuinely respect research. If you need a piece of equipment, you get it. Anyway, that's what my friends tell me. Here we are.
She took me into a laboratory crammed with video equipment. Black boxes stacked on metal shelves and on metal tables. Cables snaking across the floor. A variety of monitors and display screens.
In the center of all this was a bearded man in his mid-30s named Kevin Hauser. He had an image on his monitor of a gear mechanism in shifting rainbow colors. The desk was littered with Coke cans and candy wrappers. He had been up all night working.
"Kevin, this is Lieutenant Smith from the LAPD. He's got some unusual videotapes he needs copied."
"Just copied?"
Hauser sounded disappointed.
"You don't want anything done to them?"
"No, Kevin," she said. "He doesn't."
"No problem."
I showed Hauser one of the cassettes. He turned it over in his hand and shrugged.
"Looks like a standard 8mm cart. What's on it?"
"High-definition Japanese TV."
"You mean it's an HD signal?"
"I guess so."
"Shouldn't be a problem. You got a playback I can use?"
"Yes."
I took the playback machine out of the box and handed it to him.
"Geez, they make things nice, don't they? Beautiful unit."
Kevin examined the controls in front.
"Yeah, that's high definition, all right. I can handle it."
He turned the box around and peered at the plugs on the back. Then he frowned. He swung his desk light over and opened the plastic flap on the cassette, exposing the tape. It had a faint silver tinge.
"Huh. Do these tapes involve anything legal?"
"Actually, they do." He handed it back to me.
"Sorry, I can't copy it."
"Why not?" "See the silver color? That's evaporated metal tape. Very high density. I'll bet the format has real-time compression and decompression coming out of the box. I can't make you a copy because I can't match the formats, which means I can't lay down the signal in an equivalent way that is guaranteed readable. I can make you a copy, but I can't be sure the copy is exact because I can't match formats. So if you have any legal issues, and I assume you do, you're going to have to take it somewhere else to get it copied."
"Like where?"
"This could be the new proprietary D4 format. If it is, the only place that can copy it is Hamaguri."
"Hamaguri?"
"The research lab in Glendale, owned by Kaikatsu Industries. They have every piece of video equipment known to man over there." I said, "Do you think they'd help me?"
"To make copies?
Sure. I know one of the lab directors, Jim Donaldson. I can call over there for you if you like."
"That would be great."
"No problem."
Hamaguri Research Institute was a featureless, mirrored glass building in an industrial park in North Glendale. I carried my box into the lobby. Behind the sleek reception desk, I could see an atrium in the center of the building and smoked glass-walled laboratories on all sides. I asked for Dr. Jim Donaldson and took a seat in the lobby. While I was waiting, two men in suits came in, nodded familiarly to the receptionist, and sat on the couch near me. Ignoring me, they spread out glossy brochures on the coffee table.
"See here," one of them said. "This is what I was talking about. This is the shot we end with. This one closes."
I glanced over, saw a view of wildflowers and snow-capped mountains. The first man tapped the photos.
"I mean, that's the Rockies, my friend. It's real Americana. Trust me, that's what sells them. And it's a hell of a parcel."
"How big did you say it is?"
"It's 130,000 acres, the biggest remaining piece of Montana that's still available. 20 by 10 kilometers of prime ranch acreage fronting on the Rockies. It's the size of a national park. It's got grandeur. It's got dimension, scope. It's very high quality. Perfect for a Japanese consortium."
"And they talked price?"
"Not yet, but the ranchers, you know, they're in a tough situation. It's legal now for foreigners to export beef to Tokyo, and beef in Japan is something like $20-$22 a kilo. But nobody in Japan will buy American beef. If Americans send beef, it will rot on the docks. But if they sell their ranch to the Japanese, then the beef can be exported, because the Japanese will buy from a Japanese-owned ranch. The Japanese will do business with other Japanese, and ranches all around Montana and Wyoming have been sold. The remaining ranchers see Japanese cowboys riding on the range. They see the other ranches putting in improvements, rebuilding barns, adding modern equipment, all that. Because the other ranches can get high prices in Japan. So the American owners, they're not stupid. They see the writing on the wall. They know they can't compete, so they sell."
"But then what do the Americans do?"
"Stay and work for the Japanese. It's not a problem. The Japanese need someone to teach them how to ranch. And everybody on the ranch gets a raise. The Japanese are sensitive to American feelings.
They're sensitive people.
The second man said, I know, but I don't like it. I don't like the whole thing.
That's fine, Ted. What do you want to do, write your congressman? They're all working for the Japanese anyway. Hell, the Japanese are running these ranches with American government subsidies.
The first man twisted a gold chain at his wrist. He leaned close to his companion.
Look, Ted, let's not get all moral here, because I can't afford it, and neither can you.
We are talking of 4% overall, and a 5-year payout on a 700 mil purchase.
Let's make sure we keep that in sight, okay?
You personally are looking at 2.4 million in the first year alone, and it's a 5-year payout, right?
I know, it just bothers me.
Well, Ted, I don't think you'll be bothered when this deal closes, but there's a couple of details we need to handle. At that point, they seemed to realize I was listening. They stood up and moved out of earshot. I heard the first man say something about assurances that the state of Montana favors and approves, and the second man was nodding slowly. The first man punched him in the shoulder, cheering him up.
Lieutenant Smith?
A woman was standing beside my chair.
Yes?
I'm Kristen, Dr. Donaldson's assistant. Kevin over at JPL called about you. Something about tapes you need help with?
Yes, I need them copied.
I'm sorry, I wasn't here to take Kevin's call. One of the secretaries took it, and she didn't really understand the situation.
How's that?
Unfortunately, Dr. Donaldson isn't here right now. He's making a speech this morning.
I see.
And that makes it difficult for us, with him not in the lab.
I just want to copy some tapes. Perhaps somebody else in the lab can help me, I said.
Ordinarily, yes, but I'm afraid it's impossible today.
It was the Japanese wall. Very polite, but a wall. I sighed. It was probably unrealistic to imagine a Japanese research company would help me, even with something as neutral as copying tapes.
I understand.
Nobody's in the lab this morning at all. They were all working late on a rush project last night, and I guess they were here to all hours. So everybody's late coming in today. That's what the other secretary didn't understand. People are coming in late. So I don't know what to tell you.
I made one last attempt. As you know, my boss is the chief of police. This is the second place I've stopped at already this morning. He's really riding me to get this duplicated right away.
I'd love to help you. I know Dr. Donaldson would be happy to. We've done special work for the police before, and I'm sure we can duplicate whatever material you have. Maybe later today. Or if you'd care to leave it with us.
I'm afraid I can't do that.
Okay, sure, I understand. Well, I'm sorry, Lieutenant. Perhaps you can come back later in the day?
She gave a little shrug.
I said, probably not. I guess it's just my bad luck that everybody had to work last night. Yes, it's a pretty unusual situation.
What was it? Something came up? Research problem?
I really don't know. We have so much video capability on site, occasionally we get a rush request for something unusual. A TV commercial that needs a special effect or something like that. We worked on that new Michael Jackson video for Sony. Or somebody needs to restore tape that has been ruined. You know, rebuild the signal. But I don't know what came up last night. Except it must have been a lot of work. Something like 20 tapes to be worked on. And a real rush. I hear they didn't finish until after midnight. I thought, it can't be. I was trying to think what Connor would do, how he would handle it. I decided it was worth a stab in the dark. I said, well, I'm sure Nakamoto is grateful for all your hard work.
Oh, they are, because it turned out real well for them. They were happy.
I said, you mentioned that Mr. Donaldson was giving a speech.
Dr. Donaldson, yes.
Where is he doing that?
At a corporate training seminar at the Bonaventure Hotel. Management techniques and research. He must be pretty tired this morning, but he's always a good speaker.
Thanks.
I gave her my card.
You've been very helpful, and if there is ever anything you think of or want to tell me, call me.
Okay.
She glanced at my card. Thank you.
I turned to go.
As I was leaving, an American in his late 20s, wearing an Armani suit and the smug look of an MBA who reads the fashion magazines, came down and said to the other two men, "Gentlemen, Mr. Nakagawa will see you now." The men leaped up, grabbing their glossy brochures and pictures, and followed the assistant as he walked in calm, measured strides toward the elevator. I went back outside, into the smog. The sign in the hallway read, "Working Together, Japanese and American Management Styles." Inside the conference room, I saw one of those twilight business seminars where men and women sit at long tables covered in gray cloth, taking notes in semi-gloom as a lecturer drones on at the podium. While I was standing there, in front of a table with the name tags of latecomers, a bespectacled woman came over to me and said, "Have you registered? Did you get your packet?" I turned slightly and flashed my badge. I said, "I would like to speak to Dr. Donaldson." "He's our next speaker. He's on in 7 or 8 minutes. Can someone else help you?" "It'll just take a moment." She hesitated. "There's so little time before he speaks." "Then you better get going." She looked as if I had slapped her. I don't know what she expected. I was a police officer and I'd asked to speak to somebody. Did she think it was negotiable? I felt irritable, remembering the young fashion plate in the Armani suit. Walking in measured steps, like a person of weight and importance, as he led the real estate salesman away. Why did that kid think he was important? He might have an MBA, but he was still just answering the door for his Japanese boss. Now I watched the woman circle the conference room, moving toward the dais where four men waited to speak. The business audience was still taking notes as the sandy-haired man at the podium said, "There is a place for the foreigner in a Japanese corporation. Not at the top, of course. Perhaps not even in the upper echelons. But there is certainly a place. You must realize that the place you hold as a foreigner in a Japanese corporation is an important one. That you are respected and that you have a job to do. As a foreigner, you will have some special obstacles to overcome, but you can do that. You can succeed if you remember to know your place." I looked at the businessmen in their suits with their heads bowed, taking notes. I wondered what they were writing. Know your place? The speaker continued. "Many times you hear executives say, 'I have no place in a Japanese corporation and I had to quit.' Or you will hear people say, 'They didn't listen to me. I had no chance to get my ideas implemented, no chance for advancement.' Those people didn't understand the role of a foreigner in Japanese society. They were not able to fit in, and so they had to leave. But that is their problem. The Japanese are perfectly ready to accept Americans and other foreigners in their companies. Indeed, they are eager to have them. And you will be accepted, so long as you remember your place." A woman raised her hand and said, "What about prejudice against women in Japanese corporations?" "There is no prejudice against women," the speaker said. "I've heard that women can't advance." "That is simply not true." "Then why all the lawsuits? Sumitomo Bank just settled a big anti-discrimination suit. I read 1/3 of Japanese corporations have had suits brought by American employees. What about that?" "It is perfectly understandable," the speaker said. "Any time a foreign corporation begins to do business in a new country, it is likely to make mistakes while it gets used to the habits and patterns of the country. When American corporations first went multinational in Europe in the 50s and 60s, they encountered difficulties in the countries they entered, and there were lawsuits then. So it is not remarkable that Japanese corporations also have some period of adjustment coming into America. It is necessary to be patient." A man said with a laugh, "Is there ever a time when it's not necessary to be patient with Japan?" But he sounded rueful, not angry. The others in the room continued to make notes. "Officer, I'm Jim Donaldson. What is this about?" I turned. Dr. Donaldson was a tall, thin man with glasses and a precise, almost prissy air. He was dressed in collegiate style, a tweed sport coat and a red tie. But he had the nerd pack of pens peeking out of his shirt pocket. I guessed he was an engineer.
I just had a couple of questions about the Nakamoto tapes.
The Nakamoto tapes?
The ones in your laboratory last night.
My laboratory? Mr., Smith, Lieutenant Smith.
I gave him my card.
Lieutenant, I'm sorry, but I don't know what you're talking about. Tapes in my lab last night?
Kristen, your secretary, said everybody in the lab was working late on some tapes.
Yes, that's true. Most of my staff.
And the tapes came from Nakamoto.
From Nakamoto?
He shook his head.
Who told you that?
She did.
I assure you, Lieutenant, the tapes were not from Nakamoto.
I heard there were 20 tapes.
Yes, at least 20. I'm not sure of the exact number, but they were from McCann Erickson, an ad campaign for Asahi Beer. We had to do a logo transformation on every ad in the campaign, now that Asahi Beer is the number one beer in America.
But the question of Nakamoto...
Lieutenant,
he said impatiently, glancing at the podium,
let me explain something. I work for Homagari Research Labs. Homagari is owned by Kaikatsu Industries, a competitor of Nakamoto. Competition among the Japanese corporations is very intense. Very intense. Take my word for it. My lab didn't do any work on any Nakamoto tapes last night. Such a thing would never happen under any circumstances. If my secretary said it did, she's mistaken. It's absolutely out of the realm of possibility. Now, I have to give a speech. Is there anything else?
No, I said. Thanks.
There was scattered applause as the speaker on the podium finished. I turned and left the room. I was driving away from the Bonaventure when Connor called in from the golf course. He sounded annoyed.
I got your page. I had to interrupt my game. This better be good.
I told him about the 1 o'clock appointment with Senator Morton.
All right, he said. Pick me up here at 10:30.
Anything else? I told him about my trips to JPL and Homagari, then my conversation with Donaldson.
Connor sighed. That was a waste of time.
Why?
Because Homagari is funded by Kaikatsu, and they're in competition with Nakamoto. There is no way they would do anything to help Nakamoto.
That's what Donaldson told me, I said.
Where are you going now?
To the USC Video Labs. I'm still trying to get the tapes copied.
Connor paused. Anything else I should know?
No. Fine. See you at 10:30.
Why so early?
10:30, he said, and hung up.
As soon as I hung up, the phone rang. You were supposed to call me. It was Ken Shubik at the Times. He sounded sulky.
Sorry, I got tied up. Can we talk now?
Sure.
You got information for me?
Listen. He paused. Are you anywhere around here?
About 5 blocks from you.
Then come by for a cup of coffee.
You don't want to talk on the phone?
Well,
come on, Ken. You always want to talk on the phone.
Chubik was like all the Times reporters. He sat at his desk in front of his computer and wore a headset and talked on the phone all day long. It was his preferred way of doing things. He had all his stuff in front of him. He could type his notes into the computer as he talked. When I was a press officer, my office had been at police headquarters in Parker Center, 2 blocks from the Times building. And still, a reporter like Ken would rather talk to me on the phone than see me in person.
Come on by, Pete.
That was clear enough. Ken didn't want to talk on the phone.
Okay, fine, I said. See you in 10 minutes.
The Los Angeles Times is the most profitable newspaper in America. The newsroom takes up one entire floor of the Times building, and thus is the area of a city block. The space has been skillfully subdivided, so you are never confronted by how large it actually is, and how many hundreds of people work there. But still it seems you walk for days past reporters sitting at clusters of modular workstations with their glowing computer screens, their blinking telephones, and their tacked-up pictures of the kids. Ken's workstation was in Metro, on the east side of the building. I found him standing by his desk, pacing, waiting for me. He took me by the elbow.
Coffee, he said. Let's get coffee.
What is it? I said. You don't want to be seen with me?
No.
Shit. I want to avoid the weasel. He's down hustling that new girl on foreign. She doesn't know any better yet. Ken nodded toward the far end of the newsroom. There, by the windows, I saw the familiar figure of Willie Wilhelm, known to everyone as Weasel Wilhelm. Willie's narrow, ferret-like face was at this moment composed into a mask of smiling attentiveness as he joked with the blonde girl sitting before a terminal.
Very cute.
Yeah, a little big in the rear. She's Dutch, Ken said. She's only been here a week. She hasn't heard about him. Most organizations had a person like the Weasel. Somebody who is more ambitious than scrupulous. Somebody who finds a way to make himself useful to the powers that be, while being roundly hated by everyone else. That was the case with Weasel Wilhelm. Like most dishonest people, the Weasel believed the worst about everybody. He could always be counted on to portray events in their most unflattering light, insisting that anything less was a cover-up. He had a nose for human weakness and a taste for melodrama. He cared nothing for the truth of any situation, and he considered a balanced appraisal weak. As far as the Weasel was concerned, the underlying truth was always strong stuff, and that was what he dealt in. The other reporters at the Times despised him. Ken and I went into the central hallway. I followed him toward the coffee machines, but he led me into the library. In the middle of the floor, the Times had a library that was larger and better equipped than many college facilities. "So, what is it about Wilhelm?" I said. "He was in here last night," Ken said. "I came by after the theater to pick up some notes I needed for a morning interview I was doing from home. And I saw the Weasel in the library, maybe 11 o'clock at night. You know how ambitious the little turd is. I could see it in his face. He had the scent of blood. So naturally, you want to know about what?" "Naturally," I said. The Weasel was an accomplished backstabber. A year earlier, he had managed to get the editor of the Sunday Calendar fired. Only at the last minute did he fail to land the job himself. Ken said, "So I whispered to Lily, the night librarian. What is it? What's the Weasel up to?" She says, "He's checking police reports on some cop." So that's a relief, I think. But then I begin to wonder. I mean, I'm still the senior Metro reporter. I still do a story out of Parker Center a couple of times a month. What does he know that I don't? For all I know, this should be my story. So I say to Lily, "What's the name of this cop?" "Let me guess," I said. "That's right," Ken said. "Peter J. Smith." "What time was this?" "About 11. "Great," I said. "I thought you'd want to know," Ken said. "I do." So I said to Lily, this is last night, I said, "Lily, what kind of stuff is he pulling?" "And he's pulling everything, all the old clips from the morgue. And apparently he's got a source inside Parker who's going to leak him internal affairs records. Some kind of hearing about child molestation. Charge brought a couple of years ago." "Ah, shit," I said. "That true?" Ken said. "There was a hearing," I said, "but it was bullshit." Ken looked at me. "Fill me in." "It was 3 years back," I said. "I was still working detective. My partner and I answered a domestic violence call in Ladera Heights. Hispanic couple, fighting, both very drunk. Woman wants me to arrest her husband. And when I refuse to, says he's sexually abusing her baby. I go look at the baby. The baby looks okay. I still refuse to arrest the husband. The woman is pissed. The next day she comes in and accuses me of sexual molestation. There's a preliminary hearing. Charges dismissed as without merit." "Okay," Ken said. "Now, you got any travel that's questionable?" I frowned. "Travel?" "The Weasel was trying to locate travel records last night. Airplane trips, junkets, padded expenses." I shook my head. "It doesn't ring a bell." "Yeah, I figured he must be wrong about that one. You're a single parent. You're not going on any junkets." "No way." "Good." We were walking deeper into the library. We came to a corner where we could see out to the metro section of the newsroom through glass walls. I saw the Weasel still talking to the girl, chatting her up. I said, What I don't understand, Ken, is why me? I mean, I got no heat on me at all. No controversy. I haven't been a working detective for 3 years. I'm not even a press officer anymore. I'm a liaison. I mean, what I do is political. So why is a Times reporter gunning for me?
At 11 o'clock on a Thursday night, you mean? Ken said. He was staring at me like I was an idiot, like there was drool coming down my chin.
I said, "You think the Japanese are doing this?"
"I think the weasel does jobs for people. He is a scumbag for hire. He does jobs for the studios, record companies, brokerage houses, even the realtors. He's a consultant. The weasel now drives a Mercedes 500 SL, you know."
"Oh, yeah?
Pretty good on a reporter's salary, wouldn't you say?"
"Yeah, I would."
"So, you got on the wrong side of somebody? You do that last night?"
"Maybe."
"Because somebody called the weasel to track you down."
I said, "I can't believe this."
"Believe it," Ken said. "The only thing that worries me is the weasel's source inside Parker Center. Somebody in the department's leaking him internal affairs stuff. You okay inside your own department?"
"As far as I know."
"Good, because the weasel is up to his usual tricks. This morning I talked to Roger Bascom, our in-house counsel."
"And?"
"Guess who called him all hot and bothered with a question last night? The weasel. And you want to guess what the question was?"
I said nothing.
"The question was, does serving as a police press officer make an individual a public personality? As in, a public personality who can't sue for libel?"
I said, "Jesus."
"Right.
And the answer?"
"Who cares about the answer? You know how this works. All the weasel has to do is call a few people and say, 'Hi, this is Bill Wilhelm over here at the L.A. Times. We're going with a story tomorrow that says Lieutenant Peter Smith is a child molester. Do you have any comment on that?' A few well-placed calls, and the story doesn't even have to run. The editors can kill it, but the damage is already done."
I said nothing. I knew what Ken was telling me was true. I had seen it happen more than once. I said, "What can I do?"
Ken laughed. "You could arrange one of your famous incidents of L.A. police brutality."
"That's not funny."
"Nobody at this paper would cover it, I can promise you that. You could fucking kill him. And if somebody made a home video, hey, people here would pay to see it on video."
"Ken."
Ken sighed. "I can dream." "Okay, there's one thing. Last year, after Wilhelm was involved in the, change of management over in Calendar, I got an anonymous package in the mail. So did a few other people. Nobody did anything about it at the time. It's pretty dirty pool. You interested?"
"Yeah."
Ken took a small manila envelope from the inside pocket of his sport coat. It had one of those strings that you wrap back and forth to close it. Inside was a series of photos printed in a strip. It showed Willie Wilhelm engaged in an intimate act with a dark-haired man, his head buried in his lap. "You can't see the weasel's face too well in all the angles," Ken said, "but it's him all right. Action snap of the reporter entertaining his source. Having a drink with him, so to speak."
"Who is the guy?"
"It took us a while. His name is Barry Borman. He's the regional head of sales for Kaisei Electronics in Southern California."
"What can I do with this?"
"Give me your card," Ken said. "I'll clip it to the envelope and have it delivered to the weasel."
I shook my head. "I don't think so."
"It'd sure make him think twice."
"No," I said. "It's not for me."
Ken shrugged. "Yeah, it might not work anyway. Even if we squeeze the weasel's nuts, the Japanese probably have other ways. I still haven't been able to find out how that story ran last night. All I hear is orders from the top, orders from the top. Whatever that means. It could mean anything."
"Somebody must have written it."
"I tell you, I can't find out. But you know, the Japanese have a powerful influence at the paper. It's more than just the ads they take.
It's more than their relentless PR machine drumming out of Washington, or the local lobbying and the campaign contributions to political figures and organizations. It's the sum of all those things and more. And it's starting to be insidious. I mean, you can be sitting around in a staff meeting discussing some article that we might run, and you suddenly realize nobody wants to offend them. It isn't a question of whether a story is right or wrong, news or not news. And it isn't a one-to-one equation, like, we can't say that or they'll pull their ads. It's more subtle than that. Sometimes I look at my editors, and I can tell they won't go with certain stories because they are afraid. They don't even know what they are afraid of. They're just afraid.
So much for a free press.
Hey, Ken said, this is not the time for sophomore bullshit. You know how it works. The American press reports the prevailing opinion. The prevailing opinion is the opinion of the group in power. The Japanese are now in power. The press reports the prevailing opinion as usual. No surprises. Just take care.
I will.
And don't hesitate to call if you decide you want to arrange mail service. I wanted to talk to Connor. I was beginning to understand why Connor had been worried and why he had wanted to conclude the investigation quickly. Because a well-mounted campaign of innuendo is a fearsome thing. A skillful practitioner, and the weasel was skillful, would arrange it so that a new story came out day after day, even when nothing happened. You got headlines like, Grand Jury Undecided on Policeman's Guilt, when in fact the grand jury hadn't met yet. But people saw the headlines day after day and drew their own conclusions. The truth was, there was always a way to spin it. At the end of the innuendo campaign, if your subject was found blameless, you could still mount a headline like, Grand Jury Fails to Find Policeman Guilty, or District Attorney Unwilling to Prosecute Accused Cop. Headlines like that were as bad as a conviction. And there was no way to bounce back from weeks of negative press. Everybody remembered the accusation. Nobody remembered the exoneration. That was human nature. Once you were accused, it was tough to get back to normal. It was getting creepy, and I had a lot of bad feelings. I was a little preoccupied, pulling into the parking lot next to the physics department at USC, when the phone rang again. It was Assistant Chief Olson.
Peter?
Yes, sir.
It's almost 10 o'clock. I thought you'd be down here putting the tapes on my desk. You promised them to me.
I've been having trouble getting the tapes copied.
Is that what you've been doing?
Sure. Why?
Because from the calls I get, it sounds like you aren't dropping this investigation, Jim Olson said. In the last hour, you've been out asking questions at a Japanese research institute. Then you've interrogated a scientist who works for a Japanese research institute. You're hanging around some Japanese seminar. Let's get it straight, Peter. Is the investigation over or not?
End of Side 4, Chainside Selector Switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.